and it was then that we both saw a bright, expanding light coming toward us from the sky above and directly ahead of us. Immediately, we realized it was an incredibly bright object, glowing with extraordinary shimmering silveriness. The closest analogy I can underscore make is the glowing coals of an oak fire, moving back and forth. It was two-thirds the size of the full double highway. When about 200 yards from us, it swerved slightly and rose over our pickup truck at an angle. We could now make out its saucer-like form and, I think, slight dome. Then, with incredible speed, it was gone. At that point, my son and I had several simultaneous thoughts. We saw this sighting as a deliberate appearance for our benefit, and ours alone, we saw it as quite friendly, and we felt that it somehow explained the bewildering occurrences of the previous night. I then remembered the only UFO situation I had ever read a bit about. The Betty and Barney Hill encounter of 1961, which I had read about primarily because I was interested in the interracial nature of their marriage. At the time, I was only casually interested in their UFO experience but, impressed by the first-rate character of the Hills, I always remembered their friendly encounter with ETs. Soon after our own experience, I wrote to Betty Hill and she has since become a close friend of our family. It is obvious that these encounters of ours, and I believe this to be the case with most, if not all, people were specifically selective, anything except random, and necessitated a good deal of careful planning and gentle maneuvering by the ETs. About 90 days after the March encounters, I began a spontaneous recall, which moved forward in a vivid and orderly fashion. In due course, my son's recall commenced. Our respective recalls, which mesh with and complement one another's, clearly indicate that the bulk of our 90 minutes of missing time involved the following events. Perhaps the most famous of the UFO abductees, Barney was black, a member of the New Hampshire Civil Rights Commission, his wife Betty a white social worker. Their abduction story first appeared in Look magazine in 1966, and later that year as the book Interrupted Journey. As the four-lane highway ends and total amnesia envelops us, we are gently but firmly forced off the highway onto a very narrow and extremely rough road. We park the pickup near the upper far end of this winding, timbered road. Then we are standing, John and I, not far from the passenger's side of the pickup. It is almost dark. Completely at ease, I can see two or three small humanoid figures climbing on the back bumper looking at the gear in the back of the truck. Up close, they are 4 to 4.5 feet tall with thin bodies and limbs, but with comparatively large heads and conspicuously large quasi-slanted eyes. There are several of these small people around us, perhaps 6 or 7, and a taller, humanoid figure almost as tall as I, 6 feet, and not as proportionately thin as the others. Our communication with them is telepathically specific. John sits down. Three of the small humanoids gather around, viewing him with as much fascination as he does them. Everyone is very pleasant. Now we are walking through the darkening woods, up a ravine and over a small ridge to the UFO that is in a rather secluded clearing some distance from the pickup. Throughout this entire, and still continuing, recall process of mine is the clear, persistent, definite sense of a brightly lit room illuminated with a kind of white light, and a deep blue glowing panel. An implant is placed very carefully up into my right nostril and well beyond. There is now an injection into my neck at the thyroid area, and then an injection into my upper center chest, thymus gland. The feeling is very powerful that the meeting has gone very well indeed from everyone's standpoint. Our tall humanoid friend walks with me back through the woods to the pickup. I feel an extremely strong, poignant sense of farewell toward the tall figure, sensing equally strong reciprocity. The tall figure and I tell each other that we will see one another again in another place in another time. I know that I have a very special relationship with the tall humanoid. Let me point out here that whenever races and cultures begin to come together, half-breeds play very important, often very critical, intermediary go-between roles. I may underscore half-breed Indian myself. Now John 3 and I are by ourselves in the pickup. We wait. Very shortly, From his window, John too watches the brightly lit UFO rise and move diagonally up into the dark clouds and beyond. We drive a short distance to the end of the road, and take the highway back to the road into Richland Center. We both feel that double amnesia was briefly induced once again at that time in order that we, still somewhat somnambulistic, would pass through their business section without stopping and perhaps attracting negative attention. Since then, there has been another encounter that involved John 3 and myself, this time in Montana. In early July of 1997, my son and I took the first long trip that we had taken together, just the two of us, since the March 1988 encounter. We traveled from Grand Forks to Idaho, where I have many family roots and connections. I purchased an excellent home way up on a mountain slope, then we headed back to Grand Forks. By the time we passed through Billings, Montana, it was 11:35 p.m. I was driving, feeling wide awake. Some very strange things began to occur after that, among them an odd light that followed us from about one half hour out of Billings onward. I became dazed, and John worried about an impending UFO encounter. We both felt very strange during this time. Suddenly, I noticed that according to the road signs we were making extremely poor time, even though I was driving between 58 and 65 miles per hour, mostly 65. And somewhere in all of underscore this was a weird blue light in the trees above the highway. We pulled into a rest stop and I checked my watch, 1:45 a.m. We knew that an ET experience had occurred, some way, somehow. We both felt good about it, although I had an upset stomach that persisted well into the next day. We continued on to North Dakota. Later, in checking, we found that it had taken us 2 hours and 10 minutes to travel 71 miles. Both John and I now feel that an encounter began about a half hour out of Billings, around the time the odd light appeared, and that this encounter lasted for about an hour. It probably took place on one of the several little rural roads off of the isolated section of the interstate we were traveling on. We have reason to believe there were cursory physical exams and medical boosts, resulting essentially in a strengthening of the beneficial effects from the 1988 encounter. In a very clear, vivid recall dream I experienced 6 months later, John and I are meeting with several ETs, one taller than the rest, all wearing white. We are outside of the pickup truck on a darkened dirt road. For a moment, I am apprehensive, but only moderately so. Then I feel an extremely powerful sense of friendly well-being coming from them. We are both fine now, couldn't be better. And we continue to see the ETs as friendly, sensitive, and considerate. In due course, it became clear to me that I had had 3 previous close encounter experiences, late May 1957, in rural Arizona when I was 23, early August 1952, in rural Arizona when I was 18, late summer 1941, in rural Kansas when I was 7. As far as we know, my son John 3 had not had any encounters prior to our experience in 1988. Since the 1988 UFO encounter experience, a great deal of recall has occurred for me. Some of this has involved their 3 previously submerged encounters. John 3 has also had much recall. We both see all of this, including the ETs, their motivations and their effects, as very positive. We certainly hope and expect to see them again. After the 1988 encounter, a number of physiological changes occurred in me. These changes began to unfold in 1988, and all have continued to this day. My son has experienced several of these changes as well. In addition, he grew more than an inch, despite being 23 years of age at the time of the ET episode. We both see all of these physical changes as positive, good indeed. In fact, I have not needed the professional services of any doctor for these past 10 years, and have had no colds or flu of any substance. Here is a list of the physical changes I have experienced, and it is still current. 1. My head hair grows much faster than my previous normal rate, at least twice as fast. 2. My eyebrows have grown much thicker and darker. 3. Hair has grown over my previously hairless or almost hairless body areas, arms, legs, stomach, chest, and continues to grow still, at a slower rate. 4. I now have a very dark beard, that is, 5 o'clock shadow, that I did not have in any sense before 1988, but that occurred rapidly. I noticed it by late in that year. My fingernails and toenails are growing 2 to 3 times faster than my previous normal rate. Now I must cut my fingernails at least once a week. Dot have grown about 1/2 inch taller. Also, my feet grew a full size from 13D to 14D in the months following the 1997 encounter. Cuts and scratches clot almost immediately and heal very fast. My gums bled every day from 1984 until soon after the 1988 encounter, when they cleared up for good. Dot residual disfigurement on the right side of my face, which stemmed from an auto wreck in 1963 when there was an attempt on my life during the Jackson movement, completely faded as of the spring of 1989. Dot my skin tone improved quickly, most skin aspirates disappearing completely, along with several scars. I've never had many wrinkles, but those I did have faded completely and did not reappear. My skin is much healthier in general, plus, my face and neck area have slimmed, as is my entire body to some extent, without any sagging skin. My circulation has improved dramatically. My eyesight always good at a distance, not so good as the years passed with regard to reading improved slowly after the encounter and is still improving. After more than 35 years of heavy smoking, I quit, in May 1989, with no physical or psychological difficulties of any kind. 15. Interestingly, my protein needs increased substantially, as did my desire for green vegetables, especially peas and broccoli. My fondness for buttermilk also increased. 16. After 1988, I have had much more energy. 17. My immunity is greatly heightened, especially with respect to colds and flus, heavy stuff in North Dakota and Idaho, and I have had no illnesses since the 1988 encounter. 18. I had suffered from a bad sinus condition, which cleared up soon after the 1988 encounter and became a very minor problem. Another change is this: ever since I was very small, I have felt psychic, and my abilities in this regard have been noticed by many people throughout the years. Ever since the 1988 encounter, my psychic abilities, telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, telekinesis have all increased dramatically. The most dramatic jump in psychic abilities after each of my encounters has been in the telekinesis dimension. But all of these abilities increased with each encounter, and are still increasing. After the 1988 encounter, I began talking openly about my UFO experiences. Most of the people I met or heard from who had experienced convincing UFO close encounters shared my positive view. In fact, virtually all of the many persons from whom I've heard since I began speaking about my own encounters, probably about 225 contacts, have been overwhelmingly positive in their perceptions of the ET encounter experience, and see their encounters as quite friendly. So I am certain that the ET's motives are positive, like us. But, like us, they do have their own self-interest to them. We're the bad kids on the block. They're doing some social work here. Physically, emotionally, and intellectually, the ETs are, I believe, very similar to ourselves. Obviously, they are ahead of us in an evolutionary sense, so there is much racism being exhibited in the public fear of UFO/ETs. Gloom and doomers use the term abduction with regard to encounters on television, in print, etc. Some abductees refer to the aliens as so ugly. This reminds one of just how racist some human views can be. A degrees it seems very probable that the social, political system or systems of the ETs are democratic and strike a balance between collective and individual well-being, drawing from the best of the group and from the best of individual creativity. They could never have accomplished what they have attained and are attaining if there existed a totalitarian mentality, or an individualistic mentality of the cutthroat fashion. They are distinctive individual personalities, working together to achieve common goals. There is no question in my mind about a relationship, an encouraging relationship, between my ET encounters and my social justice work. Most of the close encounter experiences I've heard from are also involved in meaningful social justice pursuits, that is, enhancement of the human condition with respect to material, libertarian, and spiritual factors, environmentally and ecologically positive activities, formulation of non-violent approaches to human problems. I, of course, many people involved in social justice have never had ET encounters, and some experiences are not given to social justice endeavors. At least, not yet, but one should not wait for a UFO encounter to do justice work. And one's labors need not be dramatic. Ultimately, the ETs can offer us many things, among them health advances and much longer life spans, which in turn will help the human race to mature. One of the most valuable gifts from the ETs would be insight into balancing collective and individual well-being. And we can, I'm sure, offer them many worthwhile gifts, both tangible and intangible. Those of us who have been fortunate enough to have experienced UFO close encounters should not focus primarily on what these experiences have done for us as individuals, but on how we can take what we have been given, what we are and what we are becoming, and use all of that to make things better around us. From Chapter 3, a systems analyst for a large international corporation, Mary Kerfoot holds graduate degrees in psychology and mathematics. She helped to found and now coordinates a support group for close encounter experiences in the Chicago area. She is also the executive director for Operation Right to Know, a political activist group that pushes for public disclosure of government withheld UFO information. The mother of two grown children, Mary is 56 years old and lives in a suburb of Chicago. When she heard about this book project from another experiencer, Mary was immediately interested in participating and telephoned me at once. I was impressed with her intelligence, wit, and generosity. She agreed to conduct our interviews late at night, after her 10-hour workdays had ended. Somewhat sleepy, I listened carefully as Mary struggled to choose the right words to express her complete thoughts on spirituality, sanity, and healing the body and soul. Me. Contact experiences have not been of the nature that you read about in many of the Popper 52-2-La books on UFO close encounters. I have not experienced, as far as I know, any kind of medical exams or experiments. And I have not been taken against my will. I have used hypnosis every week for a couple of years, and nothing like that has come out. I can't remember anything even remotely like an abduction. Healing incidents are very common with UFO experiences. People report them all the time. But certain researchers do not want to hear this. They want to believe that it is like the Stockholm syndrome, that we are identifying with our captors and simply want to believe we are being healed. But the medical profession is acknowledging these kinds of miracle healings, recognizing the fact that they are significant even though we may not understand them. I can recall having three different healing type experiences. The first one I see as a preventative type of healing, and it is very complicated. It occurred when I was a child and is part of the first memories I have of life. The other two, more recent incidents are much simpler. The first fairly recent incident was in June of 1994, after my right eye was removed in a Chicago hospital because of a series of traumas to it. From about the age of 16, I exhibited symptoms of keratoconus, a disorder in which the cornea of the eye pokes out. It is like when you put your finger inside a balloon and the balloon projects outward. The vision is very distorted. The only way the vision can be corrected is with contact lenses, and after that a corneal transplant may be required. I had 4 corneal transplants, due to graft rejections. Then I was pruning some lilac bushes one day, and I leaned forward and ran into a bulb. I lacerated the cornea and iris, so I needed another corneal transplant. But the eye just gave up. It was shot. It began to atrophy and it was looking horrendous. I required a new eye. After surgery, I was brought from the recovery room into my hospital room. I began to notice these puffs of air that seemed to be delivered to the eye socket. I remembered some instructions I'd been given, instructions not to be alarmed when I felt the puffs of air. So I figured the doctors were doing this to help the healing process. Then I began to hear a ticking sound inside my head. That really alarmed me because, I thought, I don't remember any instructions about an alarm clock. But I thought, well, maybe it's something to keep the puffs of air delivered at regular intervals. It never occurred to me that I might possibly be hallucinating, because I was very alert. A day later, I was released. I went back to the hospital the day after that for a checkup. Now, the way they do artificial eyes nowadays is that they put some sort of acrylic ball in the socket. A plastic shell rests on that, and the eye muscles are attached to the ball. In my case, they took a section of tissue from my hip and placed it in front of the acrylic ball and attached the muscles to that. The theory is that the blood vessels in the tissue will vascularize this ball, because it is porous, and it will all knit into one integrated piece so that the muscles will work the ball. Well, the oculoplastic surgeon was quite amazed at the degree of healing that had taken place. He looked at the ball and the tissue and said, "This is a miracle. The ball is 85% vascularized. It generally takes 3 weeks to progress this far." I said, "Oh, I think that's because of your instructions about the puffs of air." And he said, "What puffs of air?" I said, "Well, there were these puffs of air." And he said, "No, we didn't give you any puffs of air. And I didn't give you any instructions either." I remembered then that the instructions had come to me in some kind of faraway state, and I began to realize that the otherworldly beings were somehow responsible for the puffs of air. I asked the surgeon if doctors were to devise some way of delivering puffs of air or oxygen to the eye socket, would healing be promoted? And he said, "Yes. Dramatically. The doctor believes that my experience was an hallucination associated with the anesthesia used during surgery. But I know the experience was real. I still have the keratoconus in my left eye. The right eye is doing all right, but I'm having a hard time getting a good fit with an acrylic shell. Plus, there was a loss of fatty tissue around the orbit, so I needed plastic surgery to build that up. But I'm getting along fine." The other recent incident took place in November of 1996. Three of us, two other experiencers and myself decided to try to make contact with the beings. These other two people have had a lot of conscious awareness of their encounter experiences, as I have. We had been wanting to make contact for some time. We all finally decided to do it. We felt we were at the point where we were ready to initiate contact and not just be acted upon. And it worked remarkably well. We were astounded at everything that happened. It was like one thing after another that evening. Now, leading up to that contact session, I had acquired this rash. I'd had it for about a year prior to that encounter, but it would come and go, getting much, much worse in times of stress. Even if it was not inflamed, it would always be there as a reddish, raised place on my inner arms and the tops of my forearms, and on my neck. And that night, I was scratching like crazy. I had actually mutilated my arms. They were bleeding and very badly scratched. And I kept scratching them that night. I guess I was feeling a lot of anxiety because the presence of the beings was really very apparent, even before we started the contact session. My dog was showing signs of nervousness, exploring the house with her little tail between her legs. And the bird was very, very hyper. I have a cockatoo named Toby. He was pacing back and forth on his perch, saying UFO, a word he picked up somehow, and making this kind of undulating sound. He was anticipating the appearance of the beings. We tried to stay awake all night, but either dozed 56, off or went into altered states from time to time. About 3:30 a.m., we all began to concentrate again on communicating with these beings. Very shortly after that, I started to go into an altered state. I felt the floor begin to vibrate, and I felt as if I were moving. One of the other people was almost being dragged away and I felt very worried for him. The other person was just staring straight ahead. She was totally zoned out, and there was an orange ball of light over her. I was awake, but I was in an altered state, a very strange state. From the perspective of the man, what he saw was an orange bubble that had encased my upper body, shoulders, arms, neck, and head. Even though my eyes were open and I was awake, I was not aware of a bubble being over me. What happened when we all came out of the altered state was a very remarkable thing. After coming out of this bubble, it was like I had new skin. All of the scratch marks and bleeding, everything was cleared up. It was just like baby soft skin. So, something happened. I don't know what. The rash eventually came back, after a couple of weeks. So that was not a permanent cure. And the unfortunate thing is, I don't know how any of this works. Just that it happens. My early healing type experiences are complicated, and have been more like a training in nature. Starting at about the age of 2½, these training experiences dealt with learning reality for this time and place. It sounds unusual, but it was a training to learn this reality, in this time, and to stay focused on this place, this reality. That way, when I was shown something that was not real or not defined as real by that experience, I knew how to know the difference and to hold on to what is real. I haven't heard anybody talk about anything like this, but this is what my early experiences were about. I always came away from these experiences with a sense of what I call the real one. I talked about the real one a lot. I was afraid that if I did not learn reality and how to stay focused, I would go mad. I was afraid of this even as a 2½-year-old. The real one wasn't a person, but signified the real versus a pale imitation. From time to time when I would be outside playing, as a child younger than 5, I would suddenly see a little boy and girl about my own age on the sidewalk. I called them the wooden people because they had no affective state, no emotions. And I just knew they had not learned reality and they had not learned how to be human. I was terrified. It was like a lesson in what would happen if I did not learn how to be human and learn how to stay focused on this reality. What seems to happen to me as a child is that impressions from a past existence were bleeding through. Apparently, the memories were not closed off for me, unlike for most children. But I knew I had to be normal. And that I had to work at it. But I got assistance. I got assistance from these beings, who drove the point home for me. I had no option but to be normal. Normal in every human way. Mostly, I don't remember what they looked like. But I remember seeing actual beings from time to time. The very first incident, when I was around 2½, occurred when I was in bed. I was lying there, facing a tall window, when suddenly a bright white light appeared. And there was a figure out there. I instantly went into this conditioned terror response. It's an underscorely unique kind of terror that I only experienced as a child confronted with either the bright white light or some kind of figure. The next thing I remember is being shown a raggedy old man looking in the window at me and holding up a lantern that gave off a pale yellow glow. I was supposed to believe that was what I had seen, instead of the other figure and the bright white light. But what I was to learn was the difference between my real experience and this imitation experience I was supposed to believe. It was like a training in differentiating screen images from reality, learning the difference between the pale imitation and the real one, and staying focused on reality. Then, about 3 years ago, I was driving home in my car when I suddenly began to relive what it was I was afraid of as a child. I was so terrified of that madness that I would have done anything to avoid experiencing it. When I actually relived it, I understood why, and why it had been such a motivating and driving factor for me. It was an indescribably horrendous state. If you were to take all of the different kinds of abnormal psychological states and subject a single person to all of these, the experience would pale in comparison to this kind of madness. And I experienced it for only a few seconds. But I felt the after effects for weeks. I called it an alien psychosis. Because it was not human. Yet, I knew it was mine. I knew that at some prior time I had been in that state of madness. And it was just horrendous.